Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival. Thank you so much for joining us in Berkeley for this lively, bookish series of events. Today we're going to have our session is called Living in Two Worlds, Crossing Borders and Identities to Create Home. My name is Michael Holtman. I'm the director of the Center for the Art of Translation and the publisher of Two Lines Press based in San Francisco. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Center for the Art of Translation, we are committed to seeking out dazzling new, overlooked and underrepresented writers brought into English by the best translators and to celebrating the art of translation. We're also staunch supporters of international literature of all kinds, which animates today's session. Before I make a couple of introductions, I wanted to thank our sponsors, which include the Center for the Art of Translation, also the Barbara Osher Pro Suecia Foundation, FILI, the Finnish Literature Exchange, and Finlandia Foundation National. So thank you to our sponsors. Joining me here today are four wonderful contemporary writers whose work is very interesting. We could spend an entire session reflecting on each one of these authors and certainly each one of the books that we'll be touching on today. So what I hope to do is kind of give you a taste of these different books and the sensibilities animating them. And have a conversation about some of these ideas about borders and identity, which I think are central to a lot of what's happening in the world today. Joining me, starting on our left, is Paitim Sadovici, author of My Cat Yugoslavia, which was translated by David Haxton. Paitim was born in 1990 and moved to Kosovo, to Finland, with his family when he was 2 years old. When it was published in Finland in 2014, I've got it right here, in case you haven't seen the book, My Cat Yugoslavia, received widespread acclaim and won the Helsingin Sanomat Literature Prize for Best Debut. The jury praised Stadovici's ability to combine the dreamlike with the realistic and to give old symbols new meaning and power. He lives in Helsinki, Finland. Carolina de Robertis is the author of The Gods of Tango, and the editor of the collection Radical Hope, Letters of Love and Dissent in Dangerous Times. She's a longtime activist who spent 10 years in the nonprofit sector before publishing her first book. And during that time, she led projects concerning issues including women's rights, immigrant rights, and addressing sexual violence. She teaches creative writing at San Francisco State University and lives in Oakland with her wife and two children. Leslie Nika Arima is the author of What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. She was born in the UK and grew up in Nigeria and wherever else her father was stationed for his work. She has been a finalist for the National Magazine Award and the Kane Prize, and a winner of the African Commonwealth Short Story Prize and an O. Henry Award, among other honors. She lives in Minneapolis. And on our right is Lale Khedivi, the author of A Good Country. She was born in Isfahan, Iran in 1977. She's the author of The Age of Orpheus, a Barnes & Noble Discover New Writer's Pick, and The Walking. She has been awarded a Whiting Award, a Pushcart Prize, and an NEA Literature Fellowship. She's also worked as a director, producer, and cinematographer of documentary films. She lives here in Northern California, not far from where we are right now. Thank you. If you could give a warm welcome to our panelists. So, as I said, we're going to kind of jump around a little bit to kind of talk about, you know, these different works and these very different writers. And I was talking with Lale as we were walking over here, and one of the things that was really exciting for me as I was going through these books is they're very different, but all really interesting in very different ways. I think we'll start with Lale, whose book, A Good Country, just came out recently. It is the story of a young man who seems in many ways very ordinary. I think One of the things I found really compelling in this book is that we learn from reading about the book, in the marketing blurb, this is a young man who ends up being radicalized, or in a sense radicalized. But when we meet him, he just seems like an ordinary teenager who, it's almost like reminds me of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, if anyone knows that book, where he's just trying to fit in with his friends. His sense of identity is one of becoming. Who is he going to be? Who does he want to be in the world? And I was hoping we could talk a little bit about this book. The one moment in the book that stood out to me is kind of a nice starting point for our conversation this afternoon is where he is with some friends, and he has thought that he would impress them by going on a surfing trip in Mexico. And they're kind of breaking some rules, and it's kind of the first time he's feeling this sense of freedom, but he's also being very defiant to his parents, who are not necessarily overbearing, but they have their own sense of his place in the world. And he's thinking about his father, who's initially depicted as kind of strong and almost severe. And he's on the border, so the literal border between the United States and Mexico. And the book's title comes from something that his father says. The main protagonist, his name's Reza, and he goes by Rez. So he's on the border, and he's thinking, the voice of his father is in his head. And he says, "America is a good country." This is his father speaking. "The shadow looked over the chaos of the border and put his hand on the hood. A good country, we should be grateful, a fair place where even an immigrant like me, no papers, no schooling, can succeed. These poor people." And then we sense that the protagonist again, Rez, he walked off into the beggars and broken streets, a dark stain in the form of his father, and before Rez could shake the sight of him, they were at the checkpoint, and Matthews leaned out the window as if he had just rolled it down. So with that kind of introduction, I was hoping we could talk a little bit about the sense of, this young man who hasn't formed a strong sense of his own identity, and how that character came to you for this book. And there's a microphone right in front. Yeah.
Oh. Yes? Okay. The character came as a constant reaction that I'm having to the times. Mm. And as I was reading through article after article from European newspapers largely and American ones about children of immigrants in Europe, UK, the Netherlands, Germany, France, who were suddenly finding that there was no place for them in these societies that their parents had adopted, had determined were going to be the place that they were going to grow up and have safety and the promise of a stable future, all of these things they couldn't find in the countries where they were from. Somehow, these children, not having been asked whether they wanted to come, watched their parents suffer in small and regular ways. And as they themselves grew up, they saw the ways in which these societies were going to disappoint them and were not going to let them access either political power or financial power or social power. Mm. And the call back by these radicalist organizations was much more appealing than anything they were hearing from the English or the French or the Germans, who had told them over and over again via the history books and the culture that you are an outsider, mm-hmm. no matter how hard you try. And as long as you are okay with this position, you will have security and financial stability and the rule of law for the most part.
Right.
And for these children, somehow, especially the boys, that was not good enough. And it was a sense that there is this character who wants to achieve the most of his selfhood. And as an Iranian American or an immigrant, a hyphenated American of any sort, that would not be possible here.
Right.
So it was the play between the tension of wanting to belong and be just a relaxed, pot-smoking surfer and also being a man who has access to himself in all of the gradations. I don't remember the other part of your question.
No.
Where he comes from.
I think, you know, you're helping give a sense of what, you know, what kind of happens in this book. We, you know, we encounter this Rez, and he's not someone who is violent. He's someone who, you know, wants to be cool. He has these friends, and what Lolly was saying just a moment ago, what is very clear, or what become, kind of accumulates over the course of the book, is, you know, it's not one moment in his life that I think there's a, almost an, maybe I make this assumption, maybe there's an assumption that people just suddenly become radicalized, that, you know, suddenly there's some specific one singular moment that really turns people. And in this book, it's really just an accumulation of events and coincidences. There's, you know, your depiction of what it's like to be, you know, there's almost like hate crime that happens in this book. You know, certainly prejudice against outsiders. And this guy, Rez, he just wants to belong. And he wants to be...
I do want to speak to the hate crime that you mentioned. And I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but writing any kind of racism or scenes of any kind of racism has always been something that... I have come to kind of heads with my editor about, and he's a conscientious man, you know, thinking broadly, but he has his shortcomings, and in talking to him about some of the scenes that had the racism and the discrimination, he asked me, you know, if there was a chance that maybe they were a bit exaggerated and that they could be slightly toned down, and I said no, and... Then he went about his business, because these are our conversations where I say no, and then he feels comfortable that he said his piece and goes on.
Right.
And then Trump was elected, and in the aftermath, both he and another person in the publishing house asked if I could sort of up the volume. if I had got it all, you know, did I really capture what was, and I was like, are you crazy? Like, this is going on all the time. You know, the artist brings it to light in their way. But that is one of the things about, you know, the idea of this panel about the notion of marginalization or writing two worlds is that one world is never going to believe the other world. And that other world is never going to totally believe the first world, you know? And inside of that tension, the storyteller is often caught.
Right.
And it's kind of a mess, you know? You have to stay true to other aspects aside from that.
So. Yeah. One of the things that's also interesting about that I found really evocative in A Good Country is that the present breaks into the story. You know, there's the moment where the Boston bombings takes place, and for these, you know, they're teenagers who, aside from having a cultural connection to Iran and to Muslim life, you know, some of them being practicing and some of them, you know, not necessarily, to kind of see how they respond or have to respond to this event as it unfolds in their school, how they kind of become targets or almost blamed for these horrors that are taking place in the world, felt, for me as a reader, just very true to life. And, you know, I have to ask, you know, were these things that were kind of happening as you were writing the book, or did you feel like you needed to capture that in some way?
Well, you know, yes, these things were happening. Not the Boston Marathon, that happened before I started the book. But I think in this age of almost kind of like a galactic terror that we all feel all the time, we are constantly looking at each other with suspicion, and I was thinking a lot about Ta-Nehisi Coates' book and what he says in there about the body and how the fear is inside the body. And when you're in the body of a Muslim man in this world, there is a lot of energy being sort of pushed in your direction. And it comes and goes as the headlines are depicting the truths of the world in the moment. And I wanted to capture how suddenly what could be a benign, accepting situation can turn.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know if many of you have read the Shirley Jackson story, where eventually that one woman gets chosen to be killed by group thought. And we live because of the frequency of information we're always getting. In a moment, we can, if we are not watchful and cautious of ourselves, we can quickly go to blame. And it's hard not to. I mean, it's hard for the city of Manchester not to, or hard for London in this moment not to.
Exactly.
It's our own awareness of saying to ourselves over and over again, you cannot just turn and demonize in an instant. And that's what happens in this, because they're high school kids, and they're at the whims of their parents' thoughts and their own half-baked thoughts, half-baked in all the ways.
In every sense.
And yeah, so I spent a lot of time thinking about the truths of that.
Well, thank you. It's a great book. Moving on, I think we'll kind of turn the idea of kind of contemporary divide to Leslie Nico Arima's book, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. This is a collection of stories and the lovely cover that I loved. It's these really, I think you capture these wonderful moments. They're formally fascinating, chiseled little viewpoints, but they are never cliched. They break into unusual directions. They're haunted by the past or by these kind of divides in people's families. There are many memorable moments. I was thinking that I'm thinking of the story Light. And there's a moment where we see people who have immigrated, and particularly in contemporary life, this can mean many different things. I mean, I think for many of us, we live, you know, our families can live across the country or across the world. We are very mobile. Technology makes it possible for us to have all kinds of different conversations. And this book helps us, you know, navigate some of the kind of emotional terrain around that. So this is a moment between this man's wife and the girl, but then her mother ruins it by adding that she can't wait till it grows out. And she's talking about her hair, and her mother has done her hair a different way. How her mother ruins it by adding that she can't wait till it grows out so she can look like a proper girl again. This starts another argument between husband and wife, mild at first, but then it peppers, and there is this thing that distance does where it subtracts warmth and context and history, and each finds that they're arguing with a stranger. And I think that that sense in your collection of stories comes out in many different ways, the sense of people becoming strangers, or someone we know is a stranger to us in some way. And I was hoping maybe you could talk about how you started putting these stories together.
Yes. With that particular story, you know, so just for those who are unfamiliar, so the father and the daughter are in Nigeria, and the father is sort of raising the daughter while her mother is in America pursuing an MBA. I wanted to write a story that sort of captured, what sort of parenting from a distance might look like. And how complicated, parenting is complicated in and of itself already, right? And in this case, the mother and the father have very different ideas of parenting, which is a hard thing to do when you're in the same house, but even a harder thing to navigate when one person is across the world. And so, you know, I thought that, you know, everyone understands, we have an understanding of how difficult it is to parents, but, you know, now let's add an extra layer of distance and what, you know, how that can sort of, you know, weaken the foundations of a marriage, of a family. And so in this story, sort of, you know, this distance and this contention sort of plays out in the arguments over the body of this girl and what it's supposed to be, and what each parent wants for her, and how even, you know, at a distance, the mother is able to sort of exert her control, but in a way that is diluted, right? It's diluted by distance. And, you know, I just thought that it wasn't. I wanted to sort of explore that because, you know, I rarely write autobiographical fiction, mm-hmm. and it's just not something that I usually do. But I did have the experience where, when we first moved to the U.S., it was myself and my siblings and my father in the U.S., and my mother was in Nigeria for a couple months before she joined us. And so there was this, you know, there was this sort of like, you know, distanced parenting thing happening. And I just thought it's not something that that people think about a lot, especially when you know, the people think about how hard that is on families to have that that sort of pressure put on it.
Right. Yeah. Which I think is, you know, for those of us with families who, you know, either have immigrated or you think of people who have moved around in a lot of different ways, the kind of, I feel like the emotional charge that appears in your stories is especially potent. And also, you know, again, kind of going back to the theme of this this panel being about identity, you know, the way in which, you know, when your home is far away and it's less accessible, the way it plays in memory and how your relationship with the present is really different from a parent. You know, I think that you kind of trouble the waters with some of those ideas. There's a really great, you know, there are many wonderful moments throughout this collection, but kind of on this point, I think, you know, for many of us, you know, I think being in the Bay Area, digital media being ever present, there's this really, a moment that I'll read from a story called Glory, and it's a way in which we frame ourselves in our communications. The story goes, on Facebook, she'd pretended to quit her job at the ad firm. A sad day indeed, an old college friend had written on her wall, making Glory suspect he knew the truth. She unfriended him right away. But Thomas's mother could not be so easily dismissed. Glory trotted out her parents' accomplishments, engineer mother, medical supply business owner father, to shore up her pedigree. Then she mentioned more recent social interests of hers, like the Igbo women's group, leaving out Thomas's hand in that. All the while, her inner voice wondered what the hell she was doing. Tricking the gods, she replied.
So, well, I, you know, I was actually tired of seeing, you know, stories, contemporary stories written, you know, set in, you know, Africa that didn't have social media, because it's just such
absolutely.
A, yeah, you know, it was, you know, it's such a huge part of contemporary life, and sometimes I feel like there is a, you know, there is a, like people tend to forget that, you know, there are people living like in the contemporary world in Africa right now, in specifically Nigeria, with my fiction, and that, you know, because a lot of our traditional infrastructure is not what it should be, like the social infrastructure is extremely important. You know, nobody, like, you know, we don't have functioning like landlines, but everybody, you know, has a cell phone. And you know, and so it's sort of become, you know, so for me, it's like to write about contemporary Nigerian life and not include social media, not include you know, the ways in which technology has facilitated our communication would be, you know, dishonest. And that, you know, there is, you know, I feel like there's an idea with fiction where technology so somehow, or including technology sometimes somehow dilutes the artisticness of the fiction because it's too modern, it's too it's too glossy, but I was like, it's real, it's the way that our world looks like right now. And I don't know anyone in Nigeria who does not for whom electronic communication is not something that's crucial to how they live their lives. One of the complaints that my friends and I have is like, who told our parents about Facebook? Our parents, yeah. Grandparents are using Facebook and WhatsApp and things like that to keep in contact with us. And so, it's just such a part of the everyday.
Right. That's very wonderfully done. I would like to turn our attention now to Carolina de Robertis, whose book, The Gods of Tango, is from 2015, but speaks very well to this conversation today. Her most recent book is a collection that she edited called Radical Hope. I hear that your talk last night sounded wonderful, and I'm sorry that I missed it, but it's a collection of letters of love and dissent in dangerous times. I encourage you to pick it up. The Gods of Tango. So this is such a rich book to mine. Clearly there's this, I'll kind of set the stage by talking a little bit about the plot of the story, which is the book opens up with a young woman who's kind of a restless soul. From Italy, and she is immigrating to Argentina, and she's leaving to meet her husband, whose name is Dante. Her name is Lita, his name is Dante. And you kind of sense immediately there's a kind of literariness in these names, which we could also discuss. But the story itself is the story of a young woman setting off on her own. I think she's like 17 when she's leaving. And she arrives in Argentina, and this man is dead. Her betrothed husband, Dante, is dead. And it's the early 20th century, Argentina. There's not really a place for women except in really small roles. And this young woman has this moment where she can either return home or she can kind of embrace impersonating a man. And in the context, she also is a, her family is very musical, and she was bringing a violin to her husband, and she remembers the lessons, even though young women aren't encouraged to play music. There are these layers, obviously the book being called The Gods of Tango, tango music becomes central to the way in which this story is told. I really like a moment in the very beginning of this story where, even on the very first page, things are kind of set in motion, and we have this sense of loss, the way in which we leave something that is behind, and that's set up in the very first page. So this young woman, Lita, is, she's at the center of this part of the story. She told herself that she would see her mother again one day, as well as her father and cousins and uncles and aunts and her great-grandmother's ceaseless dragonfly hands. Though none of it was true, in the years and continent to come, Lita would see many things that would astound her, break her into pieces, and reassemble her in shapes she had known a human soul could inhabit, but she would never see her family again. I'm curious, with so much, in my very brief description of this book, what was your entry into this woman's life, into this story, and how it needed to be told in Argentina with tango music as the backdrop?
Well, first of all, thank you all for being here. Good afternoon. And it is such an incredible pleasure to be on a panel with each of you. I admire your work so much. So it's really a joy. In terms of entry into the book, one of my This is my third novel, and one of my sort of guiding beacons as a novelist is three words from Toni Morrison, and that is that novels are inquiries. So they begin with an urgent, burning question, something that you want to know, and you explore that question. You don't necessarily answer it, but you explore it in your fiction, and then more questions kind of proliferate from that one. So the very, very first seed for this novel was actually a piece of truth from my family stories. So I am mostly from Uruguay. My mother's from Uruguay. My father is Uruguayan, but the child of exiled Argentinians. And so it's kind of, and I grew up in three different countries. So there's also this sort of, almost like an onion, an immigrant within an immigrant within an immigrant is how I see myself. So there's also this piece about peeling back layers that has always been a sort of a core obsession for me as a writer. So even the title of this panel, like, you know, the relationship between writing and weaving fiction and creating home is intrinsic for me. So the seed story that I knew I wanted to kind of try to grow a novel from was my great-grandmother, who immigrated from a very tiny village in Italy at the age of 17. And she did marry her cousin. It was her second cousin in real life. In the book, it's a first cousin. It's kind of like, you know, dramatize it a little bit. But then the dramatizing starts, right? Because you take that seed and of truth and you plant it in the fertile soil of fiction and imagination, and it grows from there. And she did cross the Atlantic in a steamboat in the early 1910s and never saw her people in Italy again. Now, she arrived, and the man she had married by proxy was alive and well, and they had children, and they sort of, you know, lived that hard-scrabble immigrant life. But I knew that that was a seed. I wanted to know more about what it might have been like to be her and be in her skin. But I also knew that I wanted to explore a much larger story that felt urgent to me, again, personally, as an immigrant within an immigrant within an immigrant, but also as a person in our current world where immigration and migration and the cultural shifting and multiple identities that are increasingly part of so many of our lives are such an urgent part of our fabric that I wanted it to really be a meditation on what it is to be an immigrant in general, on, and also not just on, I mean, I think it's very important to tell stories about the difficulty of being an immigrant, the heartbreak and the loss of being away from your homeland, the incredible challenges and, you know, cultural and racial and linguistic and spiritual and psychic barriers that you could encounter as an immigrant. But I also knew I wanted to get into this other part, which is the incredible contributions that immigrants make to the cultures into which they arrive, and the incredible act of cultural creativity and even artistry that it is to make a life as an immigrant, living in a country or culture or environment that is not the same as your root place. And the tango is kind of a perfect thing to explore for that, because I think very few people in this country think of the tango. You know, we have these images from Hollywood that are very stereotypical, and there's the rose in the hair and the fishnets, and that's all well and good. The tango's so sexy. Sure, yes, it's sexy. That's great. But it's also a music that was formed in the working class neighborhoods of Buenos Aires, among the poor, among the immigrants, and not just immigrants, but also descendants of African slaves. So there were Afro-Argentines. There was a time in Buenos Aires when the nation was one-third black. I mean, excuse me, Buenos Aires, the city, not the nation. The city was one-third black. Very few people know this. You know, Buenos Aires is known as a very white Latino city. And so what is that story? And the roots, sort of the Afro-Argentine roots of the tango, the music, the way in the music and the polyphonic beats are still kind of under the surface. The bandoneon came from the German immigrants, the sort of Russian violin, Lebanese immigrants. Everyone was mixing in these homes where it was like 60 people in a place where, you know, everyone's renting a room for a family, his bachelor's piled up, two broken toilets, you know, and that's how people were living. And they made this music to survive, right? To get through their days. I thought it was a good place to kind of explore that piece about survival, but also cultural innovation and cultural creativity, that these people collectively created a music that's now known all over the world. And the very first innovators were never documented. The poor people. Later, the wealthier people got into it, and now, you know, we have these famous names in the tango, but this is like way before Piazzolla, you know? This is like way before. It's the unvarnished old guard, where women couldn't play instruments. So this is the other thing, right? It's like this woman who's drawn to the tango, who's drawn to that depth of that world, who wants to be an artist, and the only way she can get in and really survive in this place by herself is to pass as a man. Right. So then it also becomes a story about gender and living large as a woman, and it also becomes very much a queer story. And I think that for me, this question about creating home and being between worlds and identities, for me personally, as a queer woman and as a queer writer, is also very much about being queer. And for many of us, coming out and shaping a life that is true and authentic for us means cultural innovation, right. Again.
Yeah. You described it so beautifully, and I love the way in which this book captures the grittiness, it really challenges. I mean, I think as Americans, like what Caroline was saying a moment ago, you know, our understanding of the tango is very different from, you know, someone who's spent time in Argentina or certainly at this time when the art form is really beginning to flourish. It's a art form that's hybrid, and I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about this story. As you're hearing Carolina describe it, it has that historical underpinning, but it becomes a very contemporary work that I think is asking these fascinating questions about gender identity and, you know, what it means to pass, the woman in this story. You know, at first it kind of seems like an experiment, and then it's something that really defines who she is. And I love, there are many moments in the book where this kind of theme comes back, but, you know, speaking of tango, the art form itself, you know, there's this scene where, you know, there's questioning about what is this art form? What is tango? And there are many kind of responses. Music is lover, Dante thought. I feel that too, but what kind of lover? A woman? A man? If the tango itself could dance with me, would it lead or follow? You know, what are you, tango, and what on earth am I? You know, these questions of the form, you know, being part of the music, as well as part of this book. I think that the book is asking these questions too as it kind of moves through time. I was wondering, you were talking a little bit about your kind of embrace of heritage and, you know, what, you know, could you talk a little bit about what tango means to you? I mean, was it something that you were listening to before? You know, is it something that you grew up with listening to? And did you feel like you needed to document that in some way?
Yes. So, you know, I grew up in three different countries, yeah. Nine of which was my country of origin. So England, Switzerland, and then the nation of California, right? So, and yes. So, which is really how I feel. I'm Californian. Yeah. U.S., yeah, sure, I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm Californian. And as well as Rioplatense. So Rioplatense is a word that means Argentinian Uruguayan of the River Plate. Yeah. So even that, like, there's the word that really encapsulates my identity is, yes, I'm Uruguayan, but really I'm Rioplatense, because I have roots on both sides of the river, but that's a word that doesn't exist in English. So there's even that act of translation, right? But back to that question about the tango. So, you know, I remember being a kid in Switzerland, just for reference, I know it sounds like the Alps and pretty and nice, but I was sort of like in the Arkansas of Switzerland. So, you know, really, really xenophobic school, like getting called stupid by the teacher and really bullied as a foreigner. Don't recommend that. It was a really tough place to be a foreigner and an outsider. And then I would go home, and my mom, you know, very much missing Uruguay. And only later do I look back and go, oh, the dictatorship was on. And of course, going home was very complicated. They never talked about the dictatorship. But now looking back, I can see what it meant for her to sort of like make her own sambachon ice cream or make milanesas and play tango music in the house. And you know, my grandmother's favorite tango, my dad used to sing it around the house. Does anyone know it? Fumando espero al hombre que yo quiero. You know it? No? Okay. It's a good one. And even that, you know, I'm living in Switzerland, and it's very Swiss, and there's this song that's like, you know, I'm smoking and waiting for my lover, and, you know, give me the smoke from your mouth. And I'm like, okay, this is like a different thing going on here. What is this? And, you know, and just this real sense that tango is more than a dance in Uruguay and Argentina. Tango is life. Tango is a music that encapsulates and captures the culture and there's a language of pain that's in the tango. Like, the tango slowed when the bandoneon showed up. It used to be fast and happy and really lewd, obscene lyrics in the early days. And then these European immigrants showed up, and they were really missing their homelands, and it slowed down. It became kind of lugubrious. And that's the mournful, like, you see the serious faces. And the music's beautiful, but it also carries this kind of nostalgia, this longing, and it is a sexual longing. There is an erotic aspect to the tango. I celebrate that. It's fantastic. There's also a piece of that longing that is deeper, that is about being an immigrant, that is about displacement, that is about a wanting that cannot be fully satisfied ever, and that's about self and culture. And I've always felt that, and I feel that my friends and community and family in Uruguay and Argentina, they all know that. People know that. People are so deeply passionate about the tango as a kind of like identity and fullness of being that I don't see visible here in the United States. And right. So I did want to kind of attempt to create a fiction that infused with that.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you. Well, that... Yeah. I think that's the perfect kind of gateway to Pai Tim's book, My Cat Yugoslavia. So you've heard a little bit about that, you know, displacement and the kind of self and creating and kind of a longing for a homeland. There's kind of a sense of violence and responding to violence and the way in which, you know, sometimes immigration is escape or required in order to survive. This book has many, many different qualities. It's to kind of distill it to these two narrative threads. One is kind of a very seemingly realistic, you know, it's a realistic story of a woman, and she's promised a husband, and we see all of these rituals around her life in what is Yugoslavia at the time. But there's another kind of taking place that, you know, these chapters are interlaced. You know, one follows the other. And we're in kind of the present moment with a young man, and it's a little more surreal. He befriends a cat. You know, you can see that he's someone who's trying to find himself and has ties to this, you know, he's an immigrant himself. But there are some strange things that are going on. And we know that early on in the book, you know, this kind of longing for a place to be loved. And interestingly enough, early in the book, he buys a snake. So he buys a python to kind of live in his apartment with him. And he brings it into his apartment, and this is how it goes. "Welcome home," I said, and smiled at it. "That's right. Welcome to your new home." When the snake withdrew beneath the table and coiled itself up, as though it was afraid of my voice, I felt almost ashamed of the place into which I had brought it. What if it didn't feel at home here? What if it felt shackled, threatened, sad, and lonely? Would what I could offer it be enough? This pokey apartment, these cold floors, and a few pieces of furniture, it was a living creature for which I was now responsible, a creature that didn't speak a language I could understand. And this is one very small moment in this book that encapsulates this kind of young man's life outside of the culture of his family. And we see it in very stark relief as this book opens up. And
I'm hoping you can help illuminate some what's happening in this book.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the story is about this family who moves from Kosovo to Finland, and the other narrator is the young woman's son who grows up in Finland, and he's an immigrant and feels somehow ashamed of his own nationality because he feels that the war that followed the years when after they moved to Finland somehow demonized his his existence in a way by always presenting his home country in a negative context, always writing about war and the violence and the restlessness in their home country. And so he buys this snake, even though he's very terrified of snakes in the books. So, but maybe he does that because he relates to it somehow, because snakes are generally pretty disliked creatures and people are afraid of them, and maybe he gets it for that reason. And I was actually inspired by this theory called animal studies when I was writing this book that states that animals have the right to represent themselves in literary contexts, and that when we write about animals, we always are guilty of stealing a voice that we don't have access to, because obviously we don't know what it is like to be an animal, but still we have novels that have animal narrators in them. Mm-hmm. So it takes an interesting turn, to my opinion, in the discussion we have in the literary world about what are we as writers allowed to write about. Mm-hmm. And so through these animals and these different kinds of snakes and cats, some talking and some ordinary.
Yes.
I was exploring this idea of how animals are can be seen as others in the same way as ethnic minorities or sexual minorities,
right,
with the vast difference that they can't defend themselves in any way.
Right.
So.
And as you can imagine, this takes both serious and comic turns. Earlier, before we started this discussion, probably the most obvious reference point for a cat in literature for me is the book Master and Margarita, some of you may know. And in that book, there's a very iconic cat named Behemoth. And I know you said that this book, if it wasn't an inspiration for your book in some way, it certainly has some reference. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that, literary.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite books of all time, The Master and Margarita, and I was definitely inspired by it. But then this cat creature that is in my book, my protagonist meets the cat in a gay bar, and the cat is very anti-immigrant,
right?
Anti
it's a racist cat,
anti-human rights, anti-queer rights, but they still have this very strong, a very stormy relationship. And the protagonist wants the cat's attention and wants the love from him, maybe because he feels that if he can get, he's so traumatized in a way that he feels that a love from someone like that somehow means more than the love that comes from another direction, because this kind of love has in some ways crossed borders and knocked down walls. Right. And so.
He's a fascinating character, and I love when the cat moves into his apartment with him, because like what you're describing, is this really interesting quality in your book where he seems to love or want the love from these kind of hateful people. And at the same time, we see kind of in this other narrative, this woman who's his mother when she is young and getting married and then starting a life. And her husband is kind of, I don't know if you would use this term, but we kind of see him before we know him, And as we get to know him, he's kind of depraved, or, you know, is this kind of broken man who is a, you know, terrible father to him.
Yeah, I wanted to like tell a story about one experience of being an immigrant, because, you know, we're always taught that our traumas and somehow make us stronger, and we gain so much fortitude and courage after we have been gone through war or something else, and there are so many books that teach that in some way, that, oh, I was kidnapped for 10 years and kept in a basement, but now I survived and I wrote this book and
and everything is fine now.
I became stronger, but in this book, in this book, it's sometimes our negative experiences and traumas don't make us stronger; they make us weaker and sad and pathetic in a way. And this is what happens for this character. Yeah. And I wanted to consciously show that, because I don't know if I believe in these other types of stories.
Right. Sure. Exactly.
Always.
Right.
Like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's something that's, you know, distinguishes your book, is this way in which there's this trauma that's present and sometimes on the margins. You know, these aren't necessarily the agents of history. You know, these aren't people who are, you know, necessarily at war or in the war or, you know, politically active in that way, but we kind of see the way in which, you know, this outside trauma and the familial trauma has a real impact on these individuals. There are also some moments that I think are so, you know, they're lighthearted or, you know, done with a light touch, but are so potent and meaningful. There's a moment where, you know, he's on a plane. This is later in the book, and he meets someone who sits down next to him, and they realize, you know, they can, you know, they strike up a conversation. They kind of make a joke about the socks, and he said, "That's pretty funny," I continued in English. "I must say they look pretty good on you." At that, he too began to laugh, and when I asked whether he happened to speak Finnish, his eyes brightened all the more. "Yes, I do," he replied, almost too eagerly, and adjusted his position in the chair. He took his red-socked foot out of my space, lifted himself on the armrests, and placed his right thumb beneath his chin. His left leg remained casually resting on his thigh. When I saw he was preparing to ask me a question, I began praying to myself. "Please don't ask about my homeland, my name, or my mother tongue. Ask me what I want to do, or about things I've done, my dreams and fears. Ask me about those things, and I'll tell you. How old are you?" You know, so you kind of have this, you know, the inner life, you know, the inner drama of someone who, you know, clearly has this outside trauma, but also doesn't want to necessarily be defined by it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly that, and because he's throughout the book being continuously read through his own nationality, and because he's learned to become ashamed of that, because it's another thing to tell someone that you come from Germany or France than to tell someone that you are from Kosovo or Somalia. I mean, he has to battle different kinds of stereotypes in the world because of his own nationality, and he picks up on this lying thing, and he wants to disregard his own nationality because of that, and that's why he's. What was the question? Sorry.
No, you were getting us there. No, it was.
I forgot
it was,
about what I was.
No,
saying.
You know, like, what
sorry.
Am I? Where am I?
But yeah.
No, I think what you're saying is that, you know, our identity is made of all of these different aspects of.
Yes.
You know, who we are, that we're not necessarily defined specifically by the place where we come from, even the conflict that a place can symbolize.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, before I do want to open it up to some questions from you, very attentive listeners and readers, but I wanted to kind of launch into at least one question for everyone to, you know, see, you know, if it's if the threads, you know, you're hearing about these other books that you may or may not be familiar with, if, you know, they resonate with you in a certain way. And one of the things that these stories kind of made me think of in hearing about your personal stories and reading your books, one of my favorite novelists is the South African writer J.M. Kitsea, and he writes in a book called Doubling the Point. He has an interview, and he has this very strange thing that he says about autobiography. He says, he's being asked about autobiography, and he says, because in a larger sense, all writing is autobiography, everything that you write, including criticism and fiction, writes you as you write it. The real question is the massive autobiographical writing enterprise that fills a life, this enterprise of self-construction, does it yield only fictions? Or rather, among the fictions of the self, the versions of the self that it yields, are there any that are truer than others? How do I know when I have the truth about myself? And I was wondering if you could, you know, if you have a sense of writing these books, you know, writing from, you know, in each of your books, there's some thread of yourself and your self histories that seem to, you know, be illuminated by these works. Is there something in that? I mean, I know, Carolina, you were saying, you know, every novel is an inquiry. You know, can you say more about that act of writing and what it sets in motion for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are really intriguing words, and I think we're not always conscious in the process of creating a book, right? Which pieces are drawn from our sort of inner utmost selves, and which parts are something that we're exploring that we feel like is unfamiliar. What is the familiar? What is the unfamiliar? Right. And I think those things kind of blur. I think that, you know, I can't speak for all novelists, but for myself certainly, and I don't think I'm entirely alone in this, one of the reasons that we write, one of the reasons that I write is to write more space into the world that I can fully inhabit, mm-hmm. like to be able to be, to more fully breathe. To, you know, the word authority has the word author in it, right? So who is the authority on your life, on culture, on who you are? One of the things for me growing up as an immigrant that I feel like I've really had in my bones all my life is that culture is not a static thing. And I think right. many people believe that culture is static, right? So, okay, there's like some really racist people in some parts of this country, just a part or two. Okay, that's never gonna change.
I've read about that.
You've heard about that, right? So for example, right, and it's entrenched, and it's generations old, mm-hmm. and nothing will ever change it because. And what I would say to that is that culture is not actually static, mm-hmm. and I think that we actually can shift culture and push it open with the narratives we tell and with the narratives we shape with our own lives. And so there's an act of cultural innovation that I think literature can be part of, really like reshaping narrative. I mean, even the piece, I loved the discussion around My Cat Yugoslavia with regard to, you know, not every immigrant gets the redemption. It's not always so great that someone has suffered. That's a Hollywood imposition of a certain narrative structure, right? So it's important to tell the stories of the people who don't make it. Like in my book, there's a young woman who's sex trafficked from Poland. She doesn't make it. You know, we don't all make it. That is true. It's also true, and I feel like we could have more room for this narrative, that the coming back to the beauty, right? The beauty of what immigrants bring to a society. So like, just think how incredibly impoverished we would be without our Mexican brothers and sisters in this country, right? The immigrants who are either Mexicans or Mexican Americans or people with Mexican roots in this country have brought so much beauty for themselves, their own communities, and for all of us, right? And so I think that we need all kinds of stories. And yes, I think there's a personal urgency that's always driving it, whether we fully see it or not.
Right.
So something that I do with most of my stories are from the perspective of Nigerian women, or Nigerian girls, and for me, like that's you know, exploring sort of the gender disparity in Nigerian culture was a very important thing for me. And you know, even though all of the women and the girls are very different from me, I still sort of, you know, use them as a vehicle to, you know, think around or talk around some of the things that are happening, and just, you know, even just like minor cultural gender interactions. And so, but also sort of I wanted to connect that to the discussion earlier about, you know, the idea that, you know, immigrants don't always survive trauma. And I, you know, one thing that I wanted to explore in my book as well was that there isn't, you know, there rarely is a triumphant moment in you know, navigating trauma. It's we get to see you know, the people who, you know, quote unquote overcome are elevated, and so that's the story that we see often. But, you know, for every one person that makes it, there are 200 that don't. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to tell the stories of the people that don't. I wanted to tell the stories of the women who were bitter, and that's something, you know, that's something like women aren't allowed to be, you know, openly and publicly bitter about, you know, things. And you know, it's funny because especially a place in Nigeria where the gender disparity is, you know, quite, you know, is, you know, quite elevated. It's like, well, yeah, actually, I do have a right to be, you know, angry that I'm not, you know, that when I'm going to, you know, search for apartments, they won't rent to a single woman because they assume that I'm a prostitute. Like, I am allowed to be angry about that. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted, I wanted to write characters who embraced their anger and their bitterness and didn't try to be better people. And, you know, and that's another thing that I want. I think that we often think of ourselves as better than we actually are. And so I wanted to write the characters who were like very much like not the people who make the admirable choices. I wanted to write characters that make terrible choices, that do wrong things, and all in service of like trying to find their own truth.
I don't know if you have anything to add about.
I was, in the quote that you read by Kotzia, I was most sort of fascinated by the word truth.
Yeah.
Which is sort of trending now in an interesting way. And the notion of truth, and I think that in the living of the two worlds or being of many places of this performance exile that we are constantly in, that truth is shifting. And my fictions are maybe an exploration of the truth in a moment, but the truth of what I'm trying to figure out and who I think I may be is constantly being pulled out from under my feet, both by myself and biology and life and also by the world around me. And in this particular character, his truth is one thing at the beginning, and it's another thing at the end. And to constantly be open to the possibility of falsities in yourself, and then more truths to come, and then falsities of those truths, and then more truths after that, is, I think, both important to being human, but also very important to being to seeing this life through the artistic lens. That there is no hard fast, there is no heroic immigrant, and there is no, you know, only victim immigrant. It is all a mess of right. those things all the time. And so the narrative has to break it down into those complexities.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then it becomes a product of yeah. Disney, or
yeah.
as my students have always heard me say.
Right. Yes. Well, we have a little time for some questions. I know that we have to borrow one of our mics here.
We are podcasting. Pardon me. We're podcasting this. And so we would ask that you please wait for Erin to get there with the microphone. She'll hold it for you, but she won't give it to you.
Nice. All right. We'll start right over here. Sure. Yeah.
I want to ask the authors, personally, what does it mean to be authentic, to be a hyphenated person? Like Carolina was saying, in your story, I guess this woman, to be authentic to herself, to be a musician, she had to be a man. So what does that mean to be authentic? You know, being hyphenated, like Lolly was talking about being Iranian American, being Asian American, whatever that means.
Yeah.
I'll jump in briefly and say I think that what does it mean to be authentic is your question, and I think that is exactly the kind of question that you could spend 1 or 10 novels exploring. It's exactly the kind of question that could drive this kind of an inquiry because it's so complex, right? Because authenticity can be fluid and looks different for different people. And that if you are an immigrant and so you're already culturally displaced in that way, and then you discover within yourself a truth that is queer and that is maybe kind of doubly invisible in different ways, both inside and outside, your root culture and your present culture, and how does all of that mix, and can you be both at once? And you know, those kinds of questions are so deep. I think that there are answers that we can find for ourselves on our road, but there's nothing definitive, and that's exactly why literature is so well positioned to explore it. So I don't know that I answered your question exactly, but just kind of opened it up and said these are exactly the kinds of questions that I think it's very exciting to ask through fiction.
I don't know.
I feel... I think that when I think about authenticity, I think I am authentic because I'm authentically Leslie Nekarima, right? And you know, the question does come up around, but I just the idea of I push so much against things that are expected of me as a Nigerian woman, and a lot of those things that I push back against are things that are questions of like, oh, an authentically African woman, and then, you know, all the things that are all the things that come with that, and I push back against that so much that I'm not interested in other people's ideas of authenticity, because those ideas are often things that are limiting to me, and I'm not interested in being limited.
Take another question. I think this.
So thanks for the awesome panel. So I had a question sort of about, because writing about, you know, cultures that are very different from sort of the predominant, you know, English-speaking cultures, I guess. So personally, I find that it's, you know, coming from a different culture, being an immigrant and writing about that, there's a danger of exoticizing or making it touristic or writing about a foreign culture or setting in such a way that it seems like you're almost exoticizing your own culture. And I'm curious if, you know, if you guys, like, you know, during drafting your work, if that concern comes up, you look at a piece and you say, huh, this is like how someone else sees it, but not how I saw it in a way. And I'm curious if that ever becomes, you know, a challenge, I guess. So,
yeah. I have things to say, so I had to grab them. No, I write to be understood by and for Nigerians. And like that is like my ideal. If you have to pick, you know, my ideal reader is me, and so I have, and so it comes with all the context and the cultural knowledge that I have, and so I wouldn't explain something to myself. Like if I know something, I don't, you know. And so like I feel like that that's really important for people who write from, you know, the non-main, if they're living in cultures where they're not part of the mainstream, to write, you know, to the audience that knows you best, you know, just for, you know, the writing is more interesting that way, right? So, you know, like explaining, oh, this dish means, blah, blah, blah. And then also, if you think about like what art is and what art is for and what we do with our art, the idea that you aren't like, that you are doing this sort of in service of something outside of you, it's like it has to be for you, because you're the one who has to sit there and, like, you know, write these 85,000 words or whatever, and you can't control how others interact and experience your work. That's all their own baggage, their own bullshit that they bring to it, and so the only person you can really concentrate on is yourself. So I say write for the audience that knows you the best, which is often you.
Yeah, this is a really, really personal question to me too, because I migrated to Finland at the age of 2 with my family, and then I wrote a book about an Albanian family that migrated in Finland from Kosovo. So I mean, it's not like we as novelists have even the power to represent anybody else or any nation or any language or any culture, except we have the power to tell the stories of the people we have chosen in our book. So when I published this book in Finland, I was pretty surprised about how I was referred to as an immigrant writer, and they made like assumptions of based on the book that Finland is seen as this kind of society, or like Kosovo is seen as this kind of society, which made me a bit worried about the whole thing because that wasn't my it wasn't in any way my mission whatsoever. So oftentimes it too happens that if you are writing from about marginalized places and marginalized people like the readers and the it will be perceived in a way that somehow highlights the parts that are exotic in the book.
Thank you for your great question. I believe that we as writers have a deep responsibility to radically imagine our worlds and sort of a contract with whatever space or realm that is that the work is coming from, that urgency that drives us to write, that we need to trust it and follow it. So what that means is in the depths of your writer's cave, you need to be absolutely and completely free. And it comes out the way it comes out. So what that means is making a distinguishing line between what it is that where you are actually, in our minds, we can pander, right? Like, oh, I want people to like it, and I want this kind of people who are different from me to like it, so I'm going to exoticize it because it might make them comfortable. Like, we need to eradicate all of that and really trust our work. But then there's also other people out there will exoticize your work, whether you did that in your mind in your writer's cave or not. And that, you got to let that that stuff go. You got to let that go. Because they're going to exoticize your work no matter how you do it, right? They're going to impose their, you know, like, those narratives will get imposed on your work no matter what. So you, inside your cave, you be free.
I think we have time for one more question. This woman right here, we're going to bring the microphone to you.
This question is first for Lale, because you referenced this earlier when you talked, but everybody, I'd love to hear your thoughts. When you referenced how your editor wanted you kind of to up the violence quotient in after the Trump election. So my question is, do you, writing about refugees or immigration and so forth in hyphenation and feel more of an urgency or even a responsibility in our day of Trump? And this horrible worldwide refugee crisis and so forth, to address that particular part of what's going on in the world today. And did you, if you wrote your book before Trump, this your current book, might you have written it differently? And will this, what's going on now, inform future work?
Okay, so I wouldn't have written it differently. The book was just the book. And like I was saying in the beginning, I'm writing in response to the things that are going on in the world. And I definitely felt that because of my upbringing and who I am, I had some sort of access to understanding someone who would radicalize and leave the country they had grown up in and move to the Middle East and join an organization that believes in an Islamic state. I had some access to that, and it was available to me. It was a muse of a kind, and so I followed it. It was it seemed necessary to give everybody a voice, because the media will only give one half a voice, and that was the sort of calling that I was responding to. These notions that were talked about a little bit earlier of exoticism and authenticity, those are almost impossible for an artist in some ways. Like, to sit down and craft a story and think about those at the same time is madness. And I do feel in some ways that to write about the body politic is also madness. Mm. Like, my job is to pull back, I absorb, I feel, I process, but the job, I think, when I sit down with the paper is to pull back away from that and tell the story that you can't turn away from. And I wasn't good at this in my first book, and I was a little bit better at it in my second book, but then as I figured out kind of how to write a little bit, I was like, okay, so this is how you tell that kind of story. And if we are going to be humanity in dialogue of any sort, if I can introduce this character who goes through this thing, which is essentially villainous on our planet today, and make him human, then I have done my job. If you can recognize him as, you don't have to like him, that's fine, but if you can recognize him as human, you will not read a headline about violence of this kind in the same way again. And that's the thing that I aim for every time I sit down, is to take apart the headline, take down the stereotypes, open it up to all of the sort of messiness that is in there, and trust that the reader has enough compassion to get to you, to get to, you know, your sort of desire for them.
I wanted to turn the question around a little bit, because I do think that people from marginalized cultures are always sort of called upon to sort of respond to, you know, the violence that are aimed at us. And so I would like to turn this around to white American writers. And say, you know, what are you going to write about in this, you know, in this country that, you know, and the things that are happening now are ostensibly happening to protect you, and to protect the way your perception of America. And so I want to know what you guys are going to write.
So, you know, I have to say, I have a student in one of my classes. Hi, USF. who had a particular access to a kind of, he's from a county in Michigan that voted Obama the last election and voted predominantly Trump this election. And I said, I just told him. I was like, you have to write this. You have to tell the story that explains this to the rest of the world, just like I have to write the story that explains a person like this, you know, and their hearts, like, you know, like, get on it, essentially.
And that will be our closing statement for you. Get on it. Get on it. Round of applause. I just want to say, you know, just my final thanks to all four of you. Thank you for writing these wonderful books. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us this afternoon. For those of you, you should buy these books, and you should get them signed across the street. So it's directly across the street from the museum. I believe you enter and then turn to the left. Yeah. So thank you for joining us today. Enjoy the Bay Area Book Festival.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.